Well, the rumor seems to have gotten around that I think connectionism is the lousiest new idea in cognitive science. This rumor is entirely unfounded, and I proposed it to Scotch this evening. In the first place, I don't think connectionism is a lousy idea. What I think it is two lousy ideas.
It's Innate Podcast, a podcast by two developmental cognitive scientists for developmental scientists and everyday folk. I am one half of the podcast, Dion, and I'm joined here by my wonderful, illustrious, and formidable co-host, Jenny Wong. Hi, Jenny.
Hi. Hi, everyone.
Today, we have the great pleasure of being joined by Dr. Melissa Kibbe. Melissa is an associate professor in the Department of Psychological and Brain Sciences at Boston University. Melissa is a brilliant and decorated scientist, having been awarded grants from such places as the National Science Foundation and the National Institutes of Child Health and Human Development. Melissa directs the Developing Minds Lab, and her research primarily focuses on how infants, children, and adults represent information about objects in the world. And as any good David Marion would, she also investigates the kinds of computations that human beings do with these representations, as well as how those representations guide behavior and action. She combines behavioral methods with computational modeling to gain insight into these fascinating questions and issues. Our plan for today will be to discuss her recent paper on language of thought in human infants. The title of the paper is The Language of Thought as a Working Hypothesis for Developmental Cognitive Science. And of course, we're going to link the paper in the show notes. Welcome, Melissa.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. I'm so happy to have you on the podcast and be able to actually discuss this recent paper. I will quickly say that typically what we do for our episodes is we have some opening segment, but because we want to respect your time, we're going to dedicate the entire segment to discussing your path to higher education and obviously, as I just alluded to, your paper on language of thought. I hope that plan sounds good for everyone.
Sounds great.
Great. So maybe we can sort of begin today with sort of a question that we've answered on earlier podcasts and that we would like to ask each of our guests. And the question is, how did your journey as a cognitive developmental scientist or a developmental cognitive scientist, I'm not exactly sure which ordering you like, I actually quite prefer developmental cognitive scientist. How did that start? And what brought you to your current position? So basically, what's your journey to higher education is really what the question is about.
Yeah. So I think like anybody, my journey was a little bit complicated. I feel like maybe nobody's journey to cognitive science is that straightforward. It's not something that people think about in high school, for example. And so a lot of people don't really learn about what cognitive science is until they actually get to college. For me, I had a bit of a long journey where I didn't really quite know exactly what I wanted to do. There are a few extended family members in my family that went to college, but I'm for the most part a first generation college student. I really had no idea what college was all about, and I didn't really know what you were meant to do in college once you got there. I sort of thought it was kind of a high school extra, right? Like you just take classes and the professors that teach you are college teachers. I had no idea research was a thing. So when I started college, I worked for a little bit and then I started college. And it was kind of during like the dot-com boom. And I was like, well, people should go to college and like learn to do something that you can make money at, like learn a trade. So I'll do computer science. Computer science is cool. I like computers. So I started as a computer science major, and I took computer science classes, some of which I loved, and some of which I thought were so boring. Like, I loved my data structures and algorithms class. Oh my gosh, like understanding how information is organized is so exciting. And then I had this class at programming in C, and I had this epiphany moment when my professor was kind of making a joke about how when you're programming a microwave, you don't want to have this kind of error. And I had this epiphany of like, I never, ever want to program a microwave. That sounds like an absolute nightmare. And like later that evening, I was talking to a friend of mine about what I loved about data structures and algorithms and what I hated about the C programming class. I was like, it's so cool thinking about how, you know, a computer that has very limited information processing capacity. Like, how do you efficiently represent information in this computer? You can do it with this structure and that structure. And then and the computer operates over these structures and you can think about how the information is represented. And I was going on and on about how excited I was about that piece of it. And my friend was like, have you ever heard of cognitive science? I was like, no, I've never heard of cognitive science. So, you know, I jumped on whatever, AltaVista or Ask Jeeves or something, you know, at the time, cognitive science, I searched for it on the internet and I started reading about it. And I was like, oh my God, this is what I'm interested in. And so I reached out to some people in the psych department at UMass Boston, where I was a student, and anybody who had the word cognitive in their, in their description. And I was like, can I talk to you about this field? And that's where I met, Zhu Jicaldi and Eric Blazer, who were my advisors in undergrad. And because I came at it from this idea of thinking about how these limited information processing systems, computers, process information, I started to be very interested in the question of how do human limited processing systems process information? And that's how I got interested in babies. So really, like, you know, in kind of pondering the questions about how do we understand cognition, I kept coming back to this idea that we can't really fully understand cognition unless we understand the starting state. Where do we come from? How do these structures originate? How do they develop? What do we start with? What do we end with? And how does our journey through life essentially shape those representations and computations that we can do with those representations? Especially in these really limited systems that don't have language yet. They have a limited conceptual repertoire. They're not speaking. They have a limited motor repertoire, right? And so that's where I got into this. So I did, you know, a little bit of research as an undergrad. I was super into the philosophy side of things as an undergrad as well. You know, I read a lot of Fodor. And that kind of shaped my decision to apply to Rutgers for grad school. And that's where I went to grad school, which was an amazing experience. And of course, Jenny's there now, which is wonderful. And then, yeah, the rest is history. I've always just been very interested in this kind of basic question of how do we formulate representations of the world with limited knowledge and resources? And then what do we do with those representations once we have them? And that's how I got here. I'm hand waving about the, you know, many, many years between undergrad and and my job here at BU. But that's kind of that's where it started. And that's how I've guided my path through grad school and through postdoc.
Now you worked with, sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you, Jenny. Go ahead. I'll let you go. Go ahead.
Oh, we're probably going to say the same kind of things. So your time at Rutgers, if I remember correctly, was kind of like the golden time of a lot of things happening. So do you want to share a little bit about your experience?
Yeah.
Like what kind of crazy historic moments?
Oh my gosh, it was fantastic. It was such a wonderful experience. So first of all, I worked with Alan Leslie primarily, who is an absolute genius. And working in his presence was like, I don't know, every little nugget of knowledge that he gave me, I was like, give me that knowledge. He's just extremely, extremely smart and kind.
I would be curious, as you're outlining this, if you can sort of shed some insight into exactly what, like, is it, you know, why you give that assessment. I'm kind of curious. I'm always curious about that. Like, what is it about Alan Leslie that led you to thinking, oh, this man is really good at his craft. This man is a genius at what he does. Like, what exactly was he doing What does he do?
Well, I mean, I think you can get a sense of Alan's genius by reading his published work. I would say that there's a few papers that are, I think, just incredibly mind-blowing. One is his analysis of what it takes to pretend and to understand pretense, basically arguing that like pretense is an aspect of theory of mind. And it's a brilliant computational analysis of what it means to understand pretense in young children. I think that, you know, part of Alan's genius is that he has like a, I would say like a keen philosophical mind. Like he can think through all of the possible arguments and their logical conclusions before, I don't know, before a coin hits the floor, I guess I'm trying to say. I mean, just, you know, if you hear him speak about these kinds of topics and you hear him lay out the problem space and then how he would address that problem space, it's like airtight. And I think that's what makes him just extremely smart, and his ability to make connections across lots of different seemingly disparate fields. And of course, his ability to recognize when a question is important to ask and when it's not, which I really appreciated as a grad student, you know, as somebody who was like, what about this? What if we ask this question? Right. He'd be like, why are we asking that question? Oh, good point. So yeah, I was working with Alan and soaking up his genius. And then also working with Eileen Cowler on kind of really like the sort of perceptual eye tracking side of things. But, you know, I was in the Rucker Center for Cognitive Science, taking classes with all of these big names in cognitive science, like Zenon Polition, you know, Jerry Fodor. I remember one time we had this class that I always think about because it was just an incredible experience. It was a class on, it was Language in Thought. It was the name of the class. And the students were me and Harry Halajian, two of us. And the faculty was Alan Leslie, Randy Galistel, Rochelle Gelman, Zenon Polition, Jerry Fodor, Lila Gleitman, Henry Gleitman, and several other just guest luminaries that were passing through. And that was every week. Harry and I would just sit there with like our little cups of coffee while these people just hashed out topics on from, you know, where do integers come from? How do we understand space? I mean, all of these like deep, deep questions in cognitive science from lots of different perspectives. And it was really, that was the kind of experience that I had in grad school that I was like, this is just fantastic. I need to soak this up. When else are you going to be in a room every week with this group of people talking about these topics? So it was really fun.
A testament to their passion for the science to week after week hash out these issues for two people.
Yeah. I mean, I think they were doing it for each other.
No, that's great. To say that I'm jealous is probably an understatement. That's fantastic.
It was really cool.
And that's great. Maybe you can tell us, it looks like another question we wanted to ask you before jumping into sort of the meat of the podcast or this episode is, whether you have any advice for students and early career researchers that happen to be interested in studying something that may not actually be immediately useful. Whether you have any advice in that direction.
No, I don't know if there is a topic that one could study that's not immediately useful. I guess I don't know what do you mean by useful, actually? Let me ask you that.
Yeah, like you mentioned that you didn't want to program a microwave, right? So like things like learning how to program a microwave or learning how to improve a search engine, like these things seem immediately useful, but things like understanding how the mind works seems like a very long thing to figure out.
No, totally. Yeah. Well, I think that there's short there's short-term skills, like I'm glad I learned C. And then there's long-term career, which is I don't want to program a microwave in C for the rest of my life, right? Mm-hmm. So I think that there's, you know, they're making those links between skills that are useful to you, but don't necessarily need to be everything that you do. I think that, you know, a career in academia can be difficult because when you're in it, you don't really know where you're necessarily going to end up. And, you know, I'll just to quote Alan Leslie, he would tell us this, you know, throughout grad school, it's like you're on a boat and you're on a ship and you're out in the middle of the ocean. When you're in grad school, you can't see where you came from and you cannot see the shore that you're going to. You're just in the middle of the ocean and you don't really have a good sense of how long the journey is going to be, where the ship is going. But there's a certain point at which you see the shore and you say, oh, you know, you have a retroactive insight that, oh, this entire journey is leading me to this point or this career. And, you know, that could look like a career in academia. That's like a very traditional path, a postdoc, you know, faculty position, et cetera, or it could look different. It can be different for anybody. I think a bit of career advice that I would have is just, you know, well, there's two. First of all, don't make this your identity, because it's impossible to deal with the rejection if you make your career your identity. And, you know, second of all, just be open to where your passion takes you. If your passion is taking you to, you know, an academic career, think about what about that academic career makes you feel passionate and excited. There are lots of different ways to kind of approach a career in ways that make you feel excited and like just motivated to go to work every day, that, you know, may not be something that would immediately occur to someone. Maybe it's not the, you know, the traditional path postdoc to faculty position track. Maybe it's some other track, but there's lots of different ways to approach a career. Just figure out what makes you excited and do that for the rest of your life if you can.
So what makes you excited? Like, why do you get up each and every day to do what you do? Like, what is it about your job that makes you excited? That's an excellent point.
I have to say, I absolutely love my job. I absolutely love my job. I get to ask really interesting questions with science. I mean, this is just like what I love about science, what I absolutely love about science is that it's creativity, but bounded, right? There's a method to it. You can be creative, but at the end of the day, you formulate hypotheses. You come up with experimental procedures to test those hypotheses. You collect the data and analyze the data according to those hypotheses. You make conclusions based on the analyses, right? I mean, it's very, very systematic. And there's something that's so very deeply appealing about being able to think kind of creatively and theoretically and very broadly about the questions that are most interesting to me. And then to be able to very, very systematically approach them using a method that we know works to design very, very clear experiments that are, you know, that the conclusions of which can allow us to at least answer a sliver of those big picture questions. And I just think that's so fun and exciting. I feel like I am so privileged and fortunate to be able to do that for my job. I love it.
I wanted to ask another side of the question. Is that all that you do for your job? Is there any part of your job that might come with like more of a, oh, I also have to do that part kind of feeling?
You know, I don't know. Maybe I'm hopelessly positive person. I always feel like I see the good in all the annoying aspects of this job, but like, I love teaching students. I love, you know, imparting to students like a love of science, especially students who say they're scared of science. So like, for example, I teach undergraduate perception. So like the big perception class at the undergraduate level. So this is a class that's neuroscience based. There's, you know, signal detection theory, there's psychophysics. There's brains, and students come into that class feeling nervous. People who say, oh, I'm not a science person. And I love being able to show students like science is for everybody. it's a method that anybody can use. And no, that's a very exciting part of my job, teaching undergraduates. You know, I honestly, I hope nobody at BU is listening, but I even like committee work.
Like you just found yourself 8 more committees.
Right. But, you know, I feel like there are important aspects to the human side of academia that are, they make the job about people, and they make it so that you're not just siloed in your own lab asking, you know, these very specific questions about your science. There are ways to expand your mind, interact with other people that you wouldn't interact with in other settings, learn about approaches that you wouldn't have learned about otherwise. And that's going to make your science better, ultimately.
So what do you tell students or people that are like, sure, science is cool. Like, why do I learn it? Why is it useful? Like, I plan to be programming for microwaves for the rest of my life. I'm perfectly happy with that. Why do I have to learn science?
Yeah, and, you know, I think that's totally fine. Like, you know, ultimately, nobody has to learn science, right? But if, let's say, you're a psych major and you have to take a perception course, I think that not only are the questions that we're asking about humanity just interesting because we're humans, right? So let me just back up and say, like, you know, everybody has senses, right? Everybody has thoughts. Everybody has minds. And there's a certain extent to which we all have folk intuitions about how that works. Some of those folk intuitions are probably right, and some of them are pretty wrong. And I think that it's useful to be able to study, to be a person studying people. It's just, it's always going to be something that you can take away from that. But I think that, you know, the ability to like be systematic about thought, operationalize what you're thinking about and be systematic about it, be able to reason through arguments. And then, and this is especially important when I tell students all the time, being able to recognize good and bad science in popular media is extremely important. Like you can go to Google News right now and like click on the health link and read a number of headlines that completely conflate correlation and causation, right? So being able to actually recognize good science from bad science, it's absolutely necessary for people to, I think, function in the society that's bombarding us with information all of the time.
This is exactly my perspective. And I might only just add that, you know, knowing how science works is, as you just put it, very useful for spotting good science and bad science and discriminating, you know, quack science from, you know, strong science, but it's also useful because you can apply it to your own life. So to give a quick example, I am a scientist, obviously. And so I approach most things scientifically and from a very critical scientific perspective. And I remember a few months ago, you know, I went to the doctor and had some routine blood work done. And my, this might be a little bit TMI, but I'm happy to share. My cholesterol was slightly elevated. And as any good scientist would, I decided, well, you know what, let me go home and sort of see what the literature says about ways, natural ways of lowering one's cholesterol. And so I stumbled on a few peer-reviewed articles basically extolling the virtues of fiber. And so I thought, you know what, here's an excellent opportunity to do some kind of sort of exciting experiment on myself. And so what did I decide to do? I decided to to start taking fiber, change nothing else about my diet. So keep eating the way I was eating up to that point, right? And only add fiber and then have a test done a few months later. And lo and behold, you know, after a few months, maybe it was about 4 months, my cholesterol was significantly lowered. And so, right, this is just like a clear example of applying science to one's life. And absolutely. And then this whole thing about, you know, what you love about your job, I'm sort of like you, you know, I'm a first generation-ish, scholar. And I remember even when I was a grad student, I was tickled by the idea that I would be getting paid to like think about big questions and to sort of try to formulate answers, however wrong they turned out to be. And so there's not a day where it's like I take my job for granted. I mean, this is, you know, it's, I'm so grateful to be able to do what it is that I do. And you know, Jenny's question, follow-up question, which was, well, are there things that that you sort of would rather not be doing or do less of? Yeah, there's some of that. But by and large, though, right, the, you know, the fact that I can wake up every day and do what I love and work with people who also love what they do and love what I do is just all the motivation I need. And so I'm just like you. Yeah, it just sort of tickles me that I can sit here and have these kind of conversations. I mean, look, we're having a conversation now about science and anyway. So
Absolutely. And that, you know, that certainly doesn't mean that there aren't problems with
that's right.
academia. There are, you know, there are absolutely systemic issues that, you know, we need to address and that I strive to address as well, you know, in academia, that's absolutely the case. And, you know, I think like, you know, loving my job and loving the work motivates me to even more to address, you know, the issues that are there in science and in academia. So yeah.
Absolutely.
Consider it. You're waiting for me.
Back in the days, back in the days. Back in the days, listening to hip hop.
Okay, so something you had said, and I think this would be a nice transition actually to your paper, in discussing what it is about science that you loved was that science is very systematic. Well, one of Fodor's principles for a language of thought is systematicity. And so maybe to sort of transition, maybe for the uninitiated, you can sort of unpack what the language of thought hypothesis is and why it was like what the motivation was for writing the paper that you wrote. Not everybody actually is familiar with what LOT is.
I'll try to, you know, I'll try to be to paint the broad strokes. I mean, you know, again, there are many, many nuances to the language of thought hypothesis, and much has been written about it. And I'm not a philosopher, but you know, if I were, I'm sure I would be able to be even more articulate about what it is, but I'll try to paint in broad strokes the general approach. So, you know, broadly, the idea of a language of thought is that our thoughts are formatted in a sort of mental language that's not our spoken language, right? It's not English. It's some mental language that's not a spoken language that you might communicate with others. And the idea is that this mental language has some structure or some grammar, sort of like a natural language, but not. And that this is what allows us to have representations that can be used to think new thoughts, essentially. So it allows us to kind of mentally manipulate representations in a systematic and combinatorial way. So to combine mental representations to think new thoughts and have new ideas. Now this is, again, it's a very broad definition, but that's the general idea. And so the idea is really that we're kind of taking seriously the idea that our thoughts have some structure, that we can have mental representations that can be used or manipulated in that structure, in a language-like way. Now, again, it's not natural language. It's not English. The language-like aspect of it comes from the idea that we can formulate kind of sentences in a language of thought that involve mental representations that are symbolic, that they're symbols. They're not iconic in that they don't look exactly like what they're representing in the world. They're symbolic, and that allows them to be combined with other mental representations that may not look exactly like what they're representing, right? And enabling us to think with those representations in new sentences. That's the general idea.
Can you give us a easy example of how something might be represented by a symbol versus an icon?
Yeah. So, you can imagine, if you, I'm looking around my office to see an object. So, imagine you're looking at a red square object, which I happen to have sitting in front of me right now. You can have a mental representation of that object that is almost like a picture, right? Essentially is an image of a red square that's in your mind. And you can imagine a red square right now. You can have a visual representation of a red square that's very much linked to what that red square looks like in the world. It has some, features that are bundled together into a representation that's quite visual. And that's analogous to what the object actually looks like in the world. There's another way to think about a red square, which is that you may have the concept of red and you may have the concept of square, and you can put those two things together to think red square. Now, if you take square out and you just have red, that's okay. Right? That if you have an image of a red square, you can't just take the red out of it without very radically, or take the square out of it without totally radically changing what that representation is. But if you have the concept red and the concept square, or the symbol red and the symbol square, you can put those things together in a language of thought to think the thought red square. So in that case, it would be a more of a symbolic and combined representation as opposed to a iconic or a sort of a sensory based representation.
So it would be fair to say that one of the properties of a language, because it really is a big proposal, a way of thinking about thought. So would it be fair to say that at least one of the key properties of a language of thought is that we have discrete representations of things in the world? As you just noted, right? We can have a representation of squareness, we can have a representation of redness, and we can combine those representations in any number of ways to come up with new thoughts. That seems like at least one of the core properties of a language of that idea.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then to also make sure that I'm sort of following, I guess, with a fair summary of what language of thought, what the language of thought hypothesis, would a fair summary be that sort of mental states are sort of syntactically structured, sort of like a sentence, and that's the sort of syntax, the way the thoughts are organized, sort of is what gives rise to what causes our thoughts and our actions. So therefore, in other words, our representations are very causal. They drive thoughts and they drive behavior by virtue of this sort of mental syntax, right? I'm just trying to map on what you're saying to language, right?
I feel like it's, again, it's sort of getting into philosophical territory to the extent that we can say thoughts drive behavior. I mean, yes, I think that thoughts probably do cause behavior. And yes, there is, the idea would be that there is if it's the case that there's sort of a propositional structure to thought, that structure plays some functional role in our thoughts and our actions.
Got it. And then one final thing before I ask you to maybe to unpack your paper, talk a bit about your paper and what the motivation was. So going back to your red square example,
Is a, you know, the idea is right that we have these decomposable representations, and you know, someone like me might ask, well, what evidence is there that these representations in fact can be pulled apart? And I think some of your own work actually sort of speaks directly to this. So an example of that would be, right, we represent squareness even though we might forget about the particular color, right? And this would be some sort of evidence, minimal evidence at least, that we can sort of take tease these representations sort of apart.
I don't know if that's actually great evidence.
No? Okay.
So I think that, let me say from my own work. So I think that, for example, I think the work you're referring to is some of my work with infants, that suggests that infants and toddlers, that suggest that when infants and toddlers are keeping track of objects that maybe are composed of some features. So let's say, you know, red squares and blue triangles, for example, it's possible for infants and adults as well to forget or to lose track of some of those features, but still remember something about the objects that they've seen. Now it's totally possible for that to be not language of thought-y at all. You can imagine a representation that you might think of as sort of a feature bundle, where a representation is a cortical representation of color and a cortical representation of shape, and visual attention is binding these features together in a sort of iconic way to represent what the object looks like in the mind. Now, if there's some failure of that binding, if I, you know, maybe I'm distracted by something else, my visual attention is taken up elsewhere, it's possible to kind of lose that binding, lose the bindings between these features, and maybe lose even a subset of those features and still have kind of an inkling or something about the representation in front of you. That doesn't need to be a symbol or anything in a language of thought at all, right? That can just purely be this kind of iconic visual representation. So for me, it's like, it's possible, this language of thought, but I don't think it is. And I think that, you know, just to, you know, to bring it into the paper, there are absolutely a lot of mental processes that are not necessarily language of thought at all. Like, it's absolutely possible to be thinking about, you know, iconic representations, to be thinking about the world in terms of what things look like or how we see things, right? That's totally plausible and often true. I think that when if we're truly looking for evidence of a language of thought, we need to, we need to formulate the conditions under which we would be convinced that something is abstract, symbolic, and combinatorial, as opposed to iconic. And that's kind of the argument that I'm making in the paper. So the paper is really arguing for formulating hypotheses under the assumption that there is or could be a language of thought. And I think the idea behind that is that I think it's, if we assume that ultimately in the end state, in the adult end state of development, I don't want to say end state of development, because I really truly think we're probably always developing, but let's say in the fully developed adult mind, that there is some language of thought, then we should be formulating developmental hypotheses around identifying language of thought-like structures, their existence in early development or their emergence in development, in order to really understand human cognition. So the example of what we just talked about, you know, what would an infant be doing in trying to remember what an object looks like when it's no longer in view, asking about what that representation, like even just the question of like, what is the representation that the infant has? to me, is a question that's formulated around the assumption of a language of thought, asking about the structure of that representation, how that infant can use that representation to drive behavior and to drive new thoughts. That is a language of thought-like hypothesis, because it's asking about the structure of a representation and then what we can do with those representations once we have them.
This is fascinating. All right, so it's interesting. Sort of, I guess, take a little issue with the last statement, which is that when we ask about what the nature of the representations are that babies have, that this is a way of formulating or asking about to what extent are those representations language of thought. But it's not really clear to me why asking about the nature of the representation necessarily is the province of a language of thought, right? It strikes me that, if the question is, if we're trying to probe what the nature of the representations are in the language of thought-like way, it seems to me that we would want to appeal to certain agreed upon properties of a language of thought. So the paper you wrote was actually a comment on a Target article by Quilty Dunn and a few others. And in that paper, which I would, and in fact, we'll link it in the show notes for folks who want to be maximally edified, is that language of thought has sort of six core properties. Technically, there's actually eight if you include the two that Fodor talks about, systematicity and productivity. But in any case, they outline six, core properties of language of thought. And it would strike me that if we're going to ask about the representation that babies have, and we're going to try to link that to a language of thought, we should be asking to what extent are those representations consistent with those properties? Not just that, what are the representations? So it's not really clear to me how asking about the representation necessarily is the province of language of thought, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, it absolutely does. So yeah. I think that, I think that you're totally right that we can ask about representation without thinking about language of thought at all. But I think that's not a responsible way to approach the science, because I think that there's ample evidence that at least adult humans, I think there's evidence that baby humans and kid humans do this as well, but at least adult humans think in a mental language that isn't necessarily their spoken language, right? And so if we think about, the goal, my goal as a cognitive scientist, I always think about that. I always say that I'm a cognitive scientist that uses development as a method, like some people might use, psychophysics as a method or MRI as a method, right? So we're using development as a method to understand the origins of human cognition. Then we need to, again, take seriously that the end state has a language of thought and look for those structures in early development. So I think you're totally right that it's not necessarily the case that anytime you're looking for a representation, you're looking for a lot like representation, right? LOT like representation. Representations can absolutely be analog. They can be iconic, right? It's theoretically possible that infants only have iconic or analog representations. It's possible. I don't think it's true, but it's absolutely possible. But that's a hypothesis. That's a hypothesis that's framed against the adult end state, that there is a structured format of thought. And so then the task of the developmentalist would be to say, okay, when does that structure emerge and how does it emerge, right? So even positing an origin state that's purely like non-language of thought-y at all assumes that there's an end state. I think that involves a mental language. And then there's a developmental hypothesis there as well about how do we even get to that point. I don't know if that answers your question.
Yeah, no, that's interesting. Now I would sort of push back and ask, well, the story you just outlined presupposes that the end state in fact is LOT like, but I guess I would also sort of take issue with that presupposition. I mean, is it in fact the case that we have unequivocal evidence that the end state is LOT, and to be even clearer, that the end state, to the extent that philosophers agree about the properties that make an LOT an LOT, that the end state adheres to those properties, it's far less clear to me that that in fact is the case. And so I think it's perfectly, I think you're absolutely right that if that is in fact the end state, our job as developmental cognitive scientists, because like you, I use development and modeling stuff as a tool to understand how we think. But if that is in fact the end state, yeah, it is the question we need to be asking, well, how do we make it to the end state? And, does an LOT begin an LOT? But it's just not clear to me that the adult end state in fact is language of thought, like, at least in terms of the properties that I've read a lot about from Fodor, but also in terms of this Quilty Dunn paper.
Yeah, I think that, that raises the question of like, what's the best evidence? And then things become a little bit circular, because I think the best evidence comes from pre-linguistic infants or non-linguistic animals, right? So an adult, you can always say, well, they have a lifetime of experience with their own language. They have a lifetime of experience with language input, right? We could all potentially be ChatGPTs, using the input that we've learned to generate what seem like new thoughts and ideas. Sure, why not? Adults are always very hard to study because of that. They have the complication of a lifetime of experience with their own language, a lifetime of experience with concepts, complex concepts, and so on. So then we start to get a little bit circular. I don't think it's circular, but we could say, okay, where does the best evidence come from? We can look for evidence of languages of thought in adults in tasks that don't depend on language. And this is like a lot of the work that like Chaz Firestone's group is doing on like combinatorial properties of vision, which I think is really excellent. And I urge everybody to take a look at that. But there is work, I think, with adults on this. But really our best evidence comes from these little, as I mentioned very early on, these limited information systems, right? Like babies, bees, fish, right? Other types of creatures that don't have spoken language. Do they show signatures of a language of thought? So there's sort of two questions here. Is there a language of thought? And or as we, from my perspective and the perspective of Quilty Dunn and colleagues, is that there are likely many languages of thought, that there's not just one format. There are likely many different languages of thought within a mind and across minds. So is there a language of thought? Is there evidence of that? That's thing one. And then thing two is, if there is, we need to formulate our developmental hypotheses, assuming that that's the case, so that we can identify where those structures occur and where they don't occur in human development and in species development as well.
I think it would be helpful. So we're going back to my, I already asked this question. I feel like asking it again. So you gave us the example of the differences of a symbolic representation versus iconic representation. So, and you were gesturing at these different sources of evidence for potentially the existence of symbolic representations in different species, different ages. I think it would be really helpful for us and the listeners to just kind of have you walk us through one of these examples. And you mentioned that your own work might not be the best example for this. And it's also interesting to hear your thoughts on what other evidence or future evidence might help us get there.
Yeah, so I mentioned this a little bit in the paper that we're discussing, about a kind of a recent direction in my lab in terms of our research program. And so I can give you a couple of examples that I think really illustrate this point. I mentioned in the paper, I talked about a classic paper by Karen Wynn, 1992. I love this paper for so many reasons, because it's extremely generative. And it's also just, it's very loaded. It's loaded with fantastic assumptions that I just love. but that makes it so exciting and generative, right? So let me describe the paper. And know, it's always a little bit hard to do these things in an audio format, but hopefully I can explain it well. So in this study, what they did was they showed infants, 5-month-old infants, scenarios in which a doll was placed on a puppet stage. So the infant is sitting, you know, on the caregiver's lap, watching the events unfold in real life on a puppet stage. So what infants see is a doll that's placed on a puppet stage. Then they see an opaque screen placed on, basically kind of roll up and cover the doll so that the doll is now out of view of the infant. The infant can't see the doll. While the doll is still occluded or hidden from view, an experimenter's hand reaches in and adds another doll behind the occluder. So now we have a situation in which the infant has seen one doll. They then saw the doll hidden. While the doll was hidden, another object was added in behind the occluder. And what they did was they lowered the screen and they showed infants one of two outcomes in the first experiment. So they either showed infants two dolls, which is what you would expect if you were holding a representation of the first doll in mind and then updating that representation to add the new doll, right? So 1 + 1 should equal 2. You should expect two things behind the screen. That should be an unsurprising outcome. Alternatively, babies saw the screen be removed and only a single object was placed on the stage, or in another condition, three objects were on the stage. So the wrong number of things. The idea is that if babies represented what was hidden behind the screen and could update that representation, doing a sort of 1 + 1 = 2, they should be surprised and look longer, spend more time looking at the display when the wrong number of objects is revealed. Right? And of course, that's what Wynn found. And this, you know, this experiment's been replicated in a number of ways. I think what's kind of cool about it is the experiment's been replicated in labs that also have very different theoretical perspectives. So there's something that infants are doing. It's been replicated not just using looking time, but also using EEG. Infants show kind of prediction error signatures when they're watching these events unfold. So it's a pretty robust finding. Now, Wynn argued that what babies were doing was arithmetic, right? So the title of the paper is, if I remember correctly, addition and subtraction in human infants, right? And she argues in the paper that the results are evidence that the results show evidence that infants have an innate early capacity for arithmetic, that they understand the numerical relationships between essentially the inputs and outputs of numerical computations, that they understand that 2 is more than 1. I mean, these are huge, huge hypotheses, right? That I think we can all agree, everyone in this show can agree are not necessarily supported by the data, right? Mm-hmm. So you can imagine that. So first of all, I love these hypotheses because they're so generative and they're so exciting and they're so provocative, right? And they're formulated in a language of thought, right? So what would it take for an infant to be doing arithmetic, right? That's the question. What would it take for an infant or anybody really to understand conceptually the inputs, the relationships between inputs and outputs, the relationship between 1 and 2, right? The relationship between n and n + 1, right? That is a functional relationship, I would argue. And this is something that I've spent the last, 5 years thinking about. So there are kind of two ways, and I talk about this in the paper. There are at least two ways that infants can be doing this. So one is a way that's just completely not language of thought at all, has nothing to do with representing ordinal relationships between objects. It has nothing to do with inputs and outputs, right? It can just be that infants see an object, they deploy some object representation. Let's say a pointer to the object's location in space, like a mental pointer, an attentional index. That's just purely bottom-up attention driven, right? They see an object, they say, oh, okay, I have a representation of an object. That That representation continues to point to the object even when the object is occluded. Seeing a new object causes them to deploy a new pointer. Now I have two attentional indexes. Okay, my two attentional indexes are pointing at this location. Now when the screen goes down, the occluder goes down, and there's only one object there, okay, well, that's kind of it's a surprise in that I have two pointers deployed, but only one object is there in the scene. This is just a kind of a failure of one-to-one correspondence between representation and the world. It doesn't really require me to understand that two attentional pointers is more than one attentional pointer, right? Or that adding a pointer causes me to increment some representation, right? There's no clear ordinal relationship between two pointers deployed and one pointer deployed, right? So this is a totally like non-computational, purely like kind of bottom-up attentional way that infants could be doing this task. And up until this point, that's what all of the evidence suggests, in my opinion. You guys can correct me if I'm wrong, but that there is always some non-language of thought-y explanation for this that doesn't require infants to represent anything about math, addition, or no relationships between objects. All right. So that's my big lead in to what I'm about to say next, which is now, okay, if we want to test the hypothesis that babies can do math, right, we need to understand what it would mean. What would that mean? And what it would mean is something that's very language of thought like, that there's some, that infants have representations that can essentially work like symbols that can be used as inputs into some function such that the function produces an ordinal relationship between the input and the output. So for example, I mentioned, n plus one, right? You can think about the successor function. The successor function is a function that you put in a symbol for a quantity. Let's say I put in two, and the successor function outputs that number incremented by one, so three, right? So I can take any input into the successor function, and it always gives me that input incremented by one. That's the output. So there's a systematicity between the inputs and the outputs. And that's how formal arithmetic is defined. It's defined as a systematic relationship between inputs and outputs. So you can think about addition is a function. You put in your two inputs, your two digits, and you output their sum, right? That's a function. So to posit that infants have an early, I don't care if it's innate, whatever, but some early sense of arithmetic, we have to find evidence for a functional relationship between inputs and outputs. We've been testing this hypothesis in babies and in kids using two different types of numerical type representation that we know babies have. And babies and kids have. So the first is kind of just representations of objects, representations of individual objects. And the second is what we call analog magnitude representations. Analog magnitude representations, as you might expect, are analog representations, right? They're, I look at the world, I look out in the world and I see a flock of geese and I have an approximate sense of how many geese there are. And I can tell the difference between this flock of geese and that flock of geese based on comparing those representations, as long as the flocks of geese have sufficiently different numbers of things in them, right? So there's some limits to this system, but the representation is thought of as being analogous to some quantity in the world. We've been testing this out by actually asking whether babies and kids can kind of do this, whether their ability to manipulate these numerical representations follows the functional rules of arithmetic. And I can hand wave over the experiments, but what we're finding is that in kids, if we look at whether their ability to kind of approximately compute with analog magnitude representations, if we look at whether that ability follows a function-like structure, we find evidence that it does not. When kids are kind of mentally manipulating analog magnitude representations, the structure of that mental manipulation does not appear to look like a function, like an arithmetic function. Not surprising, these representations are analog. They're not really symbolic, right? They're analogous to some representation in the world. But if we look at babies, when we do our kind of a very subtle manipulation of the Win92 method, where we ask whether babies can basically do something like compute a successor function over individual object representations, we actually find evidence that they can. And I think this is evidence that, you know, it's, first of all, it's a way to take these provocative hypotheses and actually test them out. But it's also, it suggests that the way that these computations are being done in infants and kids can be language of thought like, and it may not be language of thought like. And being able to formulate hypotheses around, okay, what would we be even looking for if we were looking for a language of thought? What would we be looking for if we were looking for evidence of arithmetic in infants and children who have not yet learned arithmetic in school? We can formulate those questions and then systematically address those questions, looking at different representational formats of quantity. I don't know if that gives you a sense of what I'm talking about, but.
Here's a question for you, based on what you just said. It's not clear to me why it would be like, why you would have an LOT signature in babies, but then it disappears in children for the same domain. So what's going on?
It's not the same domain though. See, this is what I'm talking about. So it's not that there's not a, I think if we did the same baby experiment with kids, they would succeed, right? It's kind of an issue of just like, which population did we decide to do these experiments in at a given time, right? So with our experiment with kids, the main difference here is that we are asking them to manipulate analog magnitude representations, so representations of large quantities in a function-like way. And I think if we did that with babies, we also wouldn't see evidence of function-like thought, right? That totally makes sense. So we've done it in kids, so why bother in babies? I guess is the thought. For the babies, we really were interested in directly testing this Win hypothesis. So, you know, I think that historically people have thought about representations of quantity in infants and kids, so in pre-linguistic populations and in populations that haven't learned math yet. We've thought about representations of quantity in this way that reflects that these representational formats might be different, but that they probably can be used in similar ways, that there are probably computations that can just be done over those representations. They're quantity representations, so why not? A lot of the work that my lab has been doing is digging into that assumption and saying that, like, okay, well, the representational formats are different. Wouldn't the computations be different as well? I mean, this, again, you invoked David Marr before, but this kind of goes back to David Marr's like point that you can do place value addition with Arabic numerals, but you can't do place value addition with Roman numerals, right? They represent the same things, but they're totally different formats. The computations that can be done over those formats are going to be different. And our lab suggests, the work from my lab suggests that that's absolutely true for these early representations of quantity as well. So for the infants, we were really interested in just like directly digging into this Win hypothesis, that what they're doing in that study is something that's arithmetic like. I think it is, which is pretty cool. But it's not always the case that anytime we manipulate representations of quantity that aren't digits or number words, that what we're doing is something that's arithmetic or function-like. And I think that's true in kids. It's true in adults as well.
Got it. This is super fascinating. And there's lots of follow-up questions I want to ask. But again, I want to be respectful of your time. But I do have a question. So the title of the paper is The Language of Thought as a Working Hypothesis for Developmental Cognitive Science. And I guess the question I have is, to what extent is a language of thought, that proposal, this idea, truly a developmental account of of cognitive development. Now, one answer that you might give is, well, one of the properties of a language of thought, if we take Fodor seriously, is productivity, right? So this capacity, this infinite capacity to come up with new expressions given a finite number of symbols or resources, right? And so the argument you might make is, well, one way in which babies might learn, that is, by which change might occur, right, which is what the question is getting at, is you combine these things in novel ways to come up with new concepts. But I guess if that's the tack you take, which may not be the tack you take, if that's the answer you give, it's not really clear to me that that's a developmental proposal, given that, you know, so an example might be, to make this a little bit clear, is, you know, I might say, well, what's 1 + 1? 1 + 1 = 2. Let's say I've never done any addition, but somehow I arrive at the concept 2. Well, for me to arrive at the concept 2 presupposes that I have the concept 2. And so it's not really clear that this is true new developmental change, if that's the answer you give. So anyway, I'm sort of rambling. I guess the question is, to what extent is LLT a developmental proposal?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot to unpack in that question.
Yeah.
One of them is Fodor's paradox, which is, how can we learn new concepts,
right,
without already having the concepts? And
that's right.
You know, that's related to language of thought, but it's kind of its own problem. But I think that without delving too deeply into that, that's definitely its own problem. But I also don't think that paradox is non-developmental, because I think that there are a few ways to be thinking about, there are a few ways I think that we can think about development. So one is the acquisition of new knowledge, right? That's one thing that's developmental. There's also maturation of the brain. There's motor development, right? There are like socioeconomic factors that contribute to development. There are like many, many forces, I guess, at work that are operating over a developing being, like, so the human infant. What I don't think is that babies are little adults, and that everything that's ever going to be there is there. I just don't think that's right. And I think that there are reasons to think that is, I think there are structural reasons to think that that's a slippery slope toward things that make me deeply uncomfortable, like eugenics themes, right? And I don't think that Fodor would be committed to those things at all. I think that the reason that I think it's an important developmental hypothesis is that it allows us to, again, to formulate questions about how those developmental forces might operate over a developing mind, by identifying the structures over which those developmental forces may operate, right? So, you know, we can kind of think about what's the structure of thought very early on? It gives us a foothold into understanding how does that early structure allow kids to learn formal things, like formal knowledge, right? Like, how does it allow them to learn formal knowledge about, how does an early ability to think about object physics allow them to acquire formal knowledge later on? How does an early ability to think about the numerical relationships between representations allow them to learn math early on, right? So that's one kind of developmental question. Another developmental question is when and how do adult-like thoughts emerge, right? Are they the product, which things are the product of maybe acquiring a language? Which things are not a product of acquiring a language? Which structures allow us to learn language? Which structures may be bootstrapped from language, right? These are totally developmental hypotheses that are absolutely consistent with the idea that there might be a structured combinatorial thought early in development that it emerges earlier than spoken language, right? So those are, I think, deeply developmental questions that you can ask, while presupposing that, you know, infants have the capacity for thought, right? I think anyone who's interacted with a baby has seen them putting things together, right? Even before they can think, you can see them kind of getting this, before they can speak, getting this connection, making new connections, making those connections and expressing those connections in their behavior, looking behavior, pointing behavior, et cetera. And I think that, you know, our approach to understanding early cognition should be taking that seriously, that babies can think. They can think before they have language. And understanding the format of those thoughts, the extent to which babies can be generative with those thoughts, and how that early structure might relate to all of the things that babies learn and do as they develop, I think that is absolutely developmental.
So just to follow up on what you just said, you were already telling us that the finding, so say that we found that infants seem to be able to compute successor function, they seem to have this rudimentary understanding of how something like addition could happen. How is it different from formal addition? And if we are building a developmental theory, how do we get from this primitive rudimentary representation to the formal representation? Like, what kind of picture would you predict, or what kind of LOT inspired picture that's also developmental could be like the story?
Yeah, not to paraphrase Alan, but I think Alan Leslie, but I think that's an empirical question, mm-hmm. right? So it's an empirical question about the way those things might link up. So, you know, one possibility is that as children are learning formal math, they can use their intuitive sense of how to manipulate mental numerical representations in the mind.
Yeah. Oh, sorry. And even more fundamental question is, how are these different? Like, I think we all agree that they are different. As you were talking, I was just imagining this example of every baby learns the words mommy at some point very, very early on, like possibly a few months old, they already learn the words mommy. Mm-hmm. And mommy is a symbolic representation of this person, mom. They must have some way to symbolically represent this concept of mom before they actually learn the word mom. But still, like, how could something like that happen? And they must be different. Their symbolic representation of a mom and the word mom are different, but how are they different?
Yeah, how are they different? I mean, they're on the surface, they're clearly representationally different, right? Like, just like, you know, a representation of an Arabic numeral and a representation of a Roman numeral are symbolically different. But ultimately, I think the question you're asking is, are they linking to the same concept? And again, it's an empirical question, and it's a difficult question. It's a really, really hard, hard question to answer. I think this is particularly tricky because as adult scientists, when we look at these structures, and I think that the number case is perfect for this, because if we're looking at, you know, how do kids kind of approximately add and subtract with analog magnitude representations. On the surface, it looks like addition and subtraction, right? It looks just like addition and subtraction. And it seems like that's the computation that they're doing. And even if they're doing a different computation, that's not purely like, okay, following the function rules of math, it looks to us like there are parallels. And it's like, well, shouldn't there be a link? Shouldn't there be a conceptual link between these early conceptual capacities and these later formal capacities? Shouldn't there be? Let's try to find it. And people do. People have tried to find it. And, you know, I know, Jenny, you know this, that we sort of find it. We sort of find these links. But in other contexts, we don't. And so that ultimately makes us ask, okay, like, you know, how do these things link up? Do they link up? Are they completely different? Can these early capacities be used to understand new concepts or formal structures? I mean, I feel like it's a hard question because we as researchers are kind of clouded by the similarity of the way these things look similar. It's like they have to be linked, and maybe they are, but maybe they're not. Again, that's an empirical question. But how do we find these links? I mean, it takes really careful experimental work, and it takes careful developmental work, like pinpointing the exact age at which you should ask this question, or pinpointing the exact series of ages at which you should ask a series of questions to be able to disentangle the relationships between these things. But I think it's hard. I mean, it's cool. It's good. People should do it. But it's hard.
Yeah, that's an excellent point, right? You've been telling us that there are these developmental changes just naturally happens in infants' brain development, infants' motor development, and a lot of things that happen at critical times, like they learn certain languages at certain points of time, learn to count at certain points of times. And all of these inspire researchers to use developmental methods to pinpoint these questions that we're interested in. And I think that's a really important point for those of us that are constantly trying to tell people how important it is to use developmental methods to understand these fundamental questions about cognition.
Yeah. I mean, I think we should still tell funders that this is important. It's important to ask these questions, but I think it's absolutely true. You know, again, as I always say, it's an empirical question whether these things link up, but you know, ultimately we're trying to figure out how we construct a very, very complex series of cognitive processes from a rudimentary set, and whether you think they're innate or not, I'm not theoretically committed to that, but I think that we're ultimately trying to understand how later complex, absolutely true that adults have more complex cognition than babies. There's no question about that. So how do we get to that point is the question. And I think that there has to be a connection between early cognitive capacities and later cognitive capacities. Of course there is. Otherwise that would be bizarre, right? Like that there would be a complete like glunk conceptual shift or disconnect between where we come from and where we're going. So I think it's there. It's just asking the questions is important, and it's hard, but it's rewarding.
Okay. By the way, thanks for indulging us in this conversation and answering these questions. As you can probably tell, I'm still not entirely convinced, but that's probably a me problem. That's definitely a me problem. And so in service of trying to, you know, fully wrap my head around your perspective and the language of thought perspective, something that I'm actually investigating in my own work that really ties quite nicely to this language of thought idea has to do with the question of, well, how do you reconcile the fact that there are well-documented limits on our information processing capacity with certain assumptions that a language of thought proposal assumes? So, you know, I keep picking on one of the properties, in particular productivity. That sort of property assumes an infinite capacity, which we don't have, right? So to tie to something more contemporary, Bayesian inference is sort of another proposal, perspective, theory that's really hot in the field. And Bayesian models do an exquisite job, actually, at accounting for a lot of data. But yet, if you sort of sit down and take the proposal seriously, which I'm actually doing in my work, it makes, I think, a number of assumptions that just are not supported by the data that we should actually care about. What I mean by that, our ultimate goal as cognitive scientists is to figure out how cognition works in the real world, which is complex, multifaceted. There's lots going on, right? And in the real world, if Bayesian inference is supposed to be something that's operating in the real world, well, then that would mean quite literally that we're sort of operating over a hypothesis space of discrete constituent, which is one of the criteria for a language of thought that mm-hmm. could potentially be infinite, not literally infinite, but could be potentially infinite. Well, at least it far exceeds our information processing capacities. And so it's not really clear to me why we would even appeal to a language of thought to explain cognition in the wild, given that the wild is really complex and sort of assumptions that that perspective makes, if we were to actually take it seriously, doesn't actually match with what we know about human cognition. At least that's what at least some of my data at the moment is both showing with infant, well, not with infants, with kids and with adults. So anyway, I'm just curious to hear what you think.
I don't know if, maybe I'm not following, but I don't know if it's the case that like Bayesian inference is incompatible with the idea that we might have like structured.
Oh, no. What I'm saying is okay. there's sort of, so actually in the Quilty and Dunn paper, and I think they did a great job at sort of saying that, what a candidate for a language of thought would be something like Bayesian inference. They're very compatible. But what I'm saying mm-hmm. is that to the extent that we use Bayesian inference or language of thought, or perhaps both, and they're actually quite similar, in the real world, it seems completely untenable, because the real world is extremely complex and the kinds of assumptions that these perspectives make don't seem to square with a lot of what we know about human cognition. And so, great, we have a language of thought in rudimentary cases, but in cases that in very simple cases with little small number of items, but like once this the space of items that we're considering increases, this the corresponding hypothesis space explodes and it's
okay.
far exceeds. Yeah. And so anyway, yeah.
So I think that I think you're totally right, but I think from my perspective, we need to make the distinction between the information that's in the world and the information that's in the mind, right? So like, yes, you're totally right that there's a ton of complex information in the world. But one upshot of positing a language of thought is that it allows us to, I think, represent very complex information in a more efficient, like in an energy efficient way. So like just from my perspective, I don't believe that a structured language of thought necessarily needs to be infinitely generative, right? Because again, if you take that to its logical conclusion, right, that you could potentially fill up all of the processing space that's in the mind, that's right. That doesn't need to be the case. I mean, a language of thought could theoretically be infinitely generative without ever being infinitely generative in practice. And that's totally fine too. But I think that, you know, if having structured representations that are not iconic. So like we talked about, like, you know, something that's an abstract symbol that can be stored, if you will, in the mind way more efficiently than a attentionally intensive bundle of features or something like this, right? So if we're talking about, you know, even our subjective experience, which yes, the world is deeply complex. My subjective experience, I'm not like being bombarded right now with all the books on my bookshelf or, you know, all of the, you know, papers around me, right? I'm not being bombarded with that right now. I'm focusing on a very discrete number of individuals in this particular conversation. And I'm potentially, I think, representing those individuals in a way that doesn't require me to put in a lot of mental effort to continue to try to maintain those representations, right? I'm able to think about them in an efficient way. I actually think that ultimately, if we posit a language of thought, we're positing something that's more efficient. It's a more efficient way of representing the world that doesn't require a ton of information processing power. And it actually allows us to perform inferences or, you know, learn new things over those constituents in a way that is, I think, more efficient, not less efficient. Well, I don't know if I've convinced you, but I think it's a more efficient way of representing.
I agree. Right. So I agree that we're not, you know, the world is complex, but we're not attending to everything. So like, obviously that complexity doesn't actually factor in. But like, I think we underestimate even the complexity among the things we entertain. So let me give you a concrete example. So if we take as an instantiation of the language of thought, Bayesian inference, I hate to pick on them, but I'm going to do it for this example. If we take that seriously, we say, okay, that's probably one instantiation of a language of thought. let's imagine that your job as a learner, right, is to figure out which of two objects is causal, right? That's your job. Well, based on just this information alone, you know that there's four possibilities. Both of them are causes, nine of them are causes, one is a cause, the other isn't cause, and then the inverse. Perfectly fine. And that seems to be well within our information processing abilities. And obviously it's not bringing in all of the complexity of the real world. You're only focusing on two things. I've only told you about two things. Now let's say, okay, I increase the number of causes from two to three. You might ask, well, that's a trivial increase. You're increasing by one. Think about the underlying hypothesis space, right? So in the first case, we're dealing with four things. In the second case, we're dealing with eight things. The hypothesis space doubles, right? Now let's go from two to four, not two to three, two to four. Well, when we go from two to four, we're going from four to 16 hypotheses, right? So we're quadrupling the hypothesis space. That's still not bringing in the complexity. But you mean to tell me that, you know, like even in that very simple case, we're, you know, I think we're underestimating the complexity that account would assume and the kind of resources that it would require, even if we ignore all of the complexity that you quite rightly indicated that we're not focusing on. So even in the very simple case, where we're focusing on a small number of things, the resources that that proposal would require doesn't seem to match. And so even in your, anyway, so that's the idea.
Yeah, but so, I mean, that's the information in the world, but, you know, are we assuming that the human mind is representing all of those different possibilities? I don't think that the human mind is.
Then to what extent is it Bayesian inference then, I guess the question, to what extent is the language of thought if we're not doing the thing that the proposal requires, to what extent is it the proposal that's underlying the cognition?
Maybe
we're not representing the full hypothesis space, we're representing a subset of it. But if the proposal itself requires a representation of the hypothesis space, but we're not representing the full hypothesis space, which is one of the requirements of the proposal, to what extent is the proposal underlying cognition?
What's the proposal? I think
Bayesian
I'm not
inference,
what
for
Bayesian
inference.
Okay, Bayesian inference.
Which is an instantiation of language of thought.
Yeah. I mean, I would argue, I think Bayesian inference doesn't have to be an instantiation of a language of thought, but that's fine. But I think that, you know, you can do Bayesian inference over any amount of information, right? It doesn't need to be the entire hypothesis space. Now that might result in errors. Right. It could result in errors, but like ultimately you're doing inference over the information that you're representing, not the information that's actually out there in the world.
Yes. But even so, what I'm saying is I think there's even an underestimation of information of the full implication of the information we're representing. Like even if we're representing three things, right? If we're applying Bayesian inference, and I think your response probably is maybe the answer, which is maybe we're not doing a full Bayesian inference. It's a quasi Bayesian inference or something like this. And maybe that's true. Yeah.
Yeah. But I think there are questions about the extent to which like Bayesian inference can explain everything. And they relate to this idea of like, how can we acquire concepts without being able to test the concepts already, test hypotheses about the concepts already. I mean, it kind of always comes back to that question. And there are definitely, you know, solutions that have been put out there that I've tried to wrap my head around that I'm still struggling with. This is definitely a question that I'm struggling with. I feel like people haven't yet resolved this paradox. But I think, you know, I think that there's a philosophical approach that you can take, which is just what even are the conditions under which we could acquire a concept or learn anything? And then there's the empirical approach, which is under what conditions do we learn things or do we make these inferences?
Yeah.
And both of those things maybe eventually will converge together to answer some of these deep and difficult questions. But I think it's important to keep the distinction in mind between like, you know, like you said, kind of what's there in the world and what's in the mind and what's the information that these inferences are even operating over.
Any other questions, Jenny, you might want to ask?
Oh yeah, I have a lot of questions. Thank you for cueing me. So, I was going to go back to our podcast name, which is called It's Innate. And we all know that Jerry Fodor is one of the most well-known nativists of this past century-ish. Do we think that, or do you think that the language of thought hypothesis as is right now is still kind of representing more of a nativist view, especially from a developmental perspective? You were saying you're not really committed to these findings in early infancy as saying that they're innate, but like, what do they say about the debates?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, Fodor's radical nativism comes from this problem that we were just discussing, which is how can you test hypotheses about a concept without having the concept already? And the kind of, you know, his solution to the problem was like, well, we must already have all the concepts, right? Like, and that's one thing. That's, I think, a separate problem from considering that there might be a language of thought. Right, you can imagine that a grammar in the mind could potentially emerge later in development, either through, you know, cortical maturation or through, you know, interactions with others in the environment, or I don't think this is true, but it's possible, hearing spoken language. Right, there are all kinds of different hypotheses, developmental hypotheses that could posit an existence of a language of thought in learners or in children who don't speak language yet, that don't require innate concepts, right? So I personally think that there probably are some innate concepts. Again, as I always say, innate does not mean present at birth, right? Like I never learned to, you know, I didn't have wisdom teeth when I was born, and I never learned to grow wisdom teeth, right? They just emerged with maturation. And that's, I think that's totally possible it's theoretically possible for cognitive processes as well. So positing that something is innate doesn't necessarily mean that it's there at birth. It just means that it's not learned, right? That's again an empirical, you can frame empirical questions around that. So I don't know if that answers your question, but I think that there's a distinction. I think it's an important distinction to make between the idea of radical concept nativism, which is one idea, and the idea that there might be languages of thought in pre-linguistic infants or in animals. That doesn't necessarily entail that those languages are necessarily innate.
In the case that we find all this consistent evidence, and there exists some pretty convincing evidence across species, across developments, across all these situations without any language input, and we find this language of thought like structures, would that tell us something about?
Yeah. Yeah. I think it tells us it's probably innate.
Yeah.
I mean, that's my theoretical perspective. You know, I think that there are ways of approaching the question of whether or not something is innate. And a lot of times that approach just involves gathering evidence, like you said, across species, across evolutionary time, across looking at pre-linguistic infants, right? Looking at, across cultures, right? So if something kind of emerges across cultures, across species, across infants, and we start to see how the environment in which we evolved may shape some of the way that our brains think about the world. Like, to me, that's not totally radical. It's just like, oh yeah, it's yet, you know, evolution is yet another developmental force that has operated over our cognitive processes. And to me, that seems totally reasonable and not controversial. It also, to me, seems like not something that I'm deeply theoretically committed to. It's just an empirical question. It's yet another developmental empirical approach to understanding cognition.
Yeah, I think we got to share a lot of your wisdom Melissa today to really disentangle, because it's very easy for people to associate theories with the person that proposed the theory and then label the person that proposed the theory and then put all the theories this person has proposed into the single bucket. So you just gave us a very clear illustration of how these separate ideas from Jerry Fodor are not necessarily the same thing, and they're related, but they don't necessarily give us the same kind of conclusions, and the empirical evidence could be supporting one but not the other, or it could be apply in one case but not a different case. And you also the examples you gave about how infants represent objects and numbers are also really clear in illustrating these points. I think that's a really, really important lesson for all of us as researchers.
Thank you
for sharing your wisdom. And also going back to something that you mentioned earlier, we don't know, like maybe all of us are just ChatGPTs, like you made this remark earlier. And so I'm curious what do you think about things like ChatGPT, like all these large language models? What do you think they have any connection with a language of thought kind of idea? Or do you think they are intelligent? How do we know?
How do we know? And so right now I feel like my main struggle with ChatGPT is I don't totally understand exactly what it is. I feel like there's a lot that we don't understand about how to even approach asking these questions. So like if I mess around with ChatGPT, for example, I can see that as I repeatedly ask it questions, it changes its answers, it adapts to my input. And so I feel like this, we're looking at this, any of these big large language models are these kind of big models that everyone's continually putting like new questions into and giving it new input. And it's almost like I always think about these as like, I know this sounds silly, but like super babies. Like each individual one is like one super baby, and we're bombarding it with input, and it's got some structure, the way that it's processing that input, and it's giving us some outputs, and we don't know what input it's getting, right? Like if we're a baby, okay, it's interacting with its parents, it's interacting at daycare. Sure, you have some sense of the structure of that input. For ChatGPT, like the super baby, who even knows where it's getting it? If there's tons, it's getting input from everywhere all at once. It's hard to even know from moment to moment whether you can ask this thing a question and get some insight into how it's thinking. I mean, so I don't know. To answer your question, I'm really right now I'm stuck in the place of how do we even ask the question? How do we even test this? How do we even design experiments to ask this question? It can't just be, I type it a question and it looks like it's, we all know, sure, maybe it passes the Turing test, but that's not enough, right? So we all know that that's not sufficient. I played around with Eliza enough back in the day to know that that's not sufficient, So how do we even ask the question? I'm still stuck there. I'm still stuck in the how, what evidence would we even need? I don't, to be honest with you, I don't know. Because I feel like I haven't, I don't have the correct operationalization. I don't have a good sense of how to even operationalize how to conduct experiments to ask this question of these large language models. So I wish I had a better answer for you, but that's where I'm still stuck. Like I know how to design an experiment with humans. Mm-hmm. I don't know how to design an experiment to understand whether ChatGPT is conscious. I wish I did.
No, I think you already gave us a really clear illustration of how it's different from people. It's different from babies, right? In all these important ways that I don't think every person that's listening to us quite grasped. And I actually only learned it the other day from my husband, who's a machine learning computer science person, that even the Turing test wasn't really proposed to tell us anything about whether something has consciousness or intelligence. It was just to illustrate that it's really not testable.
Yeah.
And I didn't really know that. And it's really helpful to realize that there are these deep philosophical questions and potentially future empirical questions that we don't even know how to start to ask. But then like my false lay belief that, oh, all these philosophers or computer scientists have all long figured out how to test these questions, only realizing that, oh, wait, actually, maybe they still have a lot to learn from us cognitive scientists. Maybe they haven't figured everything out. Yeah.
But I think, you know, ultimately, I think it's the question of whether ChatGPT can think is something that we need to take really seriously. I mean, I've watched enough Star Trek to know that we need to take seriously the possibility that we could possibly have made an emerging life form.
Yeah.
Like, you know, if that's the case, then, you know, we have some responsibilities, right? So I think it's really important to consider that ChatGPT could be intelligent or that these large language models could be intelligent. I just don't know how to test it. I wish I did.
I think Michael Frank's Twitter thread tries to provide at least one way of possibly applying experimental methods from psychology to test these models. But you're right, they're really hard to test. I do feel obliged. Yeah, right. I agree. I do feel obliged to sort of just quickly say that, you know, it is true that we don't actually know exactly what the need for the input is to these models or the innards of these models, other than their large language models, their neural networks, really complex neural networks, really large neural networks. But that aside, I still think there's something, like, I still think it's really impressive that these models can learn strictly from data to do really impressive things that in the 90s were thought to be inconceivable. So, you know, Gary Marcus, who everyone seems to know, you know, wrote, you know, this book in the 90s, and he did some work on rule learning, right? And one of his principal arguments is that, you know, rule learning, which is a language of thought, like a compatible with language of thought, right, is something that a neural network cannot possibly do. But it's funny that, you know, when you test the large language models now on some of the exact same problems that he was proposing, that he's presenting babies, these models solve the problems flawlessly. And these are some of the same kind of neural network models that he was criticizing and saying weren't able to sort of do some of the things that his babies were able to do, right? And so, yeah, there's limits and stuff, but it's really impressive that these models can learn to do really complicated things, putting aside whether or not this is true cognition, whether or not it's true thinking and true intelligence, that, you know, again, just 10 to 15 years ago, we thought, you know, was inconceivable. So I think it's worth bringing that point. Yeah.
I think it's amazing. I mean, yeah. And again, just, you know, just like we need to be careful about what we consider cognition in humans, I think we need to be careful about what we consider cognition.
Yeah.
Like, just because it looks like something that humans do, or just because it looks like something, you know, that we've observed in humans, doesn't necessarily mean it's the same kind of cognition. But that also doesn't mean that it's not cognition.
Yeah,
you know, like,
right.
You know, it could be, what I think is really exciting about these large language models is that it could be a new cognitive system that we actually get to study. Like, we get to study cognition in another thing that we created, cognition in, which is pretty wild if you think about it. And this is a case where we actually do have the algorithms. Like, we wrote the algorithms. We don't have to reverse engineer the algorithms by looking at, you know, inputs and outputs of human beings. Like, we can literally see the algorithms.
That's right.
Cool. I mean, that is really, really interesting. But, you know, ultimately what we call, you know, consciousness or intelligence, I mean, I think we have to be very careful about that. I think there's ethical reasons to be concerned about it. There's slippery slope reasons to be concerned about it. But that's a tough one that I do not have an answer for.
Yeah, no, I agree. Well, in any case, thank you so much for joining us today to talk about a range of topics, most especially what language of thought is, and thank you for tolerating my likely insufferable questions. I mean, do you have anything you wanted to say, Jenny, before we wrap up completely?
Oh, thank you. Thank you for sharing your wisdom, Melissa. And thank you for showing us all these different ways to think about different things. And we really enjoyed our conversation. And hopefully we'll get to hear about your new exciting research in a future episode.
This was really fun.